Hi, my name is Martin Purnell and welcome to the last episode of 2024 regarding off-grid Christianity. We will be back, of course, in 2025. Together with other contributors, we want to celebrate and fly the flag for a life well lived. The man concerned is Tony Campolo, who sadly passed away on the 19th of November 2024. With me to celebrate and discuss further, amongst other contributors, is Steve Goddard. Before we discuss who Tony Campolo was and why he meant such a lot to you and me and other contributors, what was your involvement with Tony Campolo, first of all, please, Steve?
Well, first of all, I was given a tape by the publisher of Buzz magazine at the time. I was the editor, called Big, Big Business versus Tiny Little Christians. And it was a cassette tape. And I thought, why is he giving me this? And it was because I'd been bemoaning the fact that there seemed to be a real disconnect between those who are into Christians who are into personal piety, more of the evangelical side, and on the other side, the kind of social action, left wing, if you like, side of things, where it was all about structural change, not about personal piety. And it's almost like the two couldn't mix and meet. And I was bemoaning the fact of this. Peter said, have a listen to this guy. He's a weird name, Campolo, but see what you think of it. And this was like something of it come from another planet. It was so revolutionary in my head because he was a sociologist. He was a theologian. He was a preacher. He was an evangelical who understood those two worlds and was trying to bring them together with a real impact and with real dynamic. And it was life-changing for me because I could see he was somebody who had atmosphere, had authority, had an approach to things that I was waiting to hear. And I didn't even know I was waiting to hear it, but there it was. And I then grabbed every conceivable cassette that was available of this guy and just devoured what he was saying. And that was an exciting time for me because it gave me a basis for editing Buzz magazine in a way that reflected those views. It gave me a new kind of framework. I mean, I understood the theology because I had a theological background, but what I didn't know, I didn't have, is that wider sociological side of things. And so he was able to bring all that together into a creative mix and to be so entertaining at the same time that I thought, this, as I say, he came from another planet.
And the thing is, for those that know hardly anything about him, he was an American Baptist pastor ordained in 1957. We'll talk more about him being an international speaker and author later on from other guests. Wikipedia states that he was an influential leader in the evangelical left. More about that as well, no doubt. He was born February 25th, 1935 in Philadelphia and was married to Peggy all his life, and they had two children. You worked throughout the 80s and 90s with him as, I suppose, what we call the unofficial press officer. Would that be right?
Correct, yeah.
You travelled a lot with him. What did he tell you about his times growing up in America and being a Baptist pastor and then stepping forth and going for it?
He grew up Orthodox. I remember him saying, people ask me if I'm theologically sound, I believed in the virgin birth before I knew what a virgin was. So there was a kind of sense that he had, as I say, a wonderful, ironic sense of humour. See, this is the issue. This is what you have to understand about Campolo. He was marinated in irony in the way that we are in Europe. He had a kind of European sense of humour.
Yes.
He understood irony. He knew how to play and work with irony.
Yes.
And a lot of people regard America as being irony free. They don't understand it. It's sort of black and white. Everything is simple. This is right. This is wrong. In fact, they don't. An awful lot of Americans are brilliant with irony. But there's a caricature that we've got of America being like that. In fact, Campolo understood our sense of humour. He understood our way of thinking. So I think that what he brought in was he had a theological background. He had a church background, but he struggled with it. He kind of had to come to his own belief and his own belief system, if you like. The system had to work for him. He had to absorb. He wanted to absorb other thinkers before he put together his own view of life and theology and sociology. As I say, he combined all these things. And therefore, when he brought these things into his preaching and his impact wherever he went, And so from my point of view, I understood his traditional background because that's my background too. But then what he did was he was prepared to bring in other influences to season it. And so it wasn't just the classic sort of evangelical position. He wrestled with all the different views of theological persuasion. And I think that was his genius.
I remember in an interview I did with him, he made reference about what it was like growing up and how he met Albert Einstein. Mm. Oh, it's an incredible story, and no doubt you and I can share that later on as well. Another guest will share about how he met Fidel Castro, which is incredible. All that to come later on. What else did he say about life growing up? What did he tell you?
Very little, I have to say. We never talked really about the past. We didn't talk about his foundation. We were always talking about now. We were talking about the impact of different characters, the impact of the evangelical right or the left. We were always talking about now. And it was almost as if we understood each other because of our backgrounds being quite similar. We almost didn't need to explain anything to each other. It was immediate. He got me and I got him. He talked obviously a lot about the fact that he had moved into a black church in Philadelphia and he was part of a church that had started as a white church and become black as time went on. He and Peggy found themselves very much sort of change all around him. And that influenced him in terms of him understanding the black church. But then he immediately kind of clicked with that because he's was a very emotional and direct and expressive faith. So the black church, which is naturally that way, would have appealed to him right from the start.
Well, you mentioned earlier on being given a tape. The tape given to you, I presume, was from Peter Meadows.
Correct.
Let's hear from Peter then, because obviously he discusses that said tape. And with me is the founder of Buzz Magazine, which is now Premier Christianity. He is also the founder of Premier Radio and co-founder of Spring Harvest. For more details, have a listen to episode 62. Gives me great pleasure to welcome Peter Meadows. Your thoughts, sir, on the late Tony Campolo and how you were instrumental in bringing him over. When did you first meet him?
Well, I first met him face-to-face actually at Spring Harvest. But in another sense, I met him because his voice blasted out of a cassette tape that I'd ordered from America because I'd seen it advertised in a youth resources magazine there. And I was intrigued by the titles. I can't remember the exact details. I think one of them was about big, big business against little, little Christians. Another one was about corporate sin. And just the subjects were so extraordinary for me because at the time, sin was something, you didn't steal paperclips from work. It was all very personal mm-hmm. and pietistic. And so not knowing anything about this guy, but knowing he'd been trusted to speak at this big event, we ordered. And the cassettes arrived. So I'm in my little yellow Cortina driving along. I whack the cassette, you know, because it's that long ago. It's cassettes, Martin, cassettes.
Yeah, yeah.
Whack it in the speaker. And within 5 minutes, I've had to pull over and park because the assault is so astounding. I've never heard anything like it. This man telling stories about stealing umbrellas and a lady's scarf caught in his zipper and a trunk full of canoes and chicken mess. But it's all pointing to the fact that God calls us to something more than personal piety. He calls us to justice and care for the poor. And it was just astounding. And I went back, shared it. I was at Buzz Magazine at the time, shared it with people like Steve Goddard and others. And we said, wow. So we, on the strength of that one tape, we invited him to Spring Harvest.
Wow.
And the first time I met him, therefore face to face, he came to our Butlin Chalet. Actually, it may not have been Butlin's. I think it was one of the other camps. I think it was a Pontius camp at the time. And there was about half a dozen people there gathered around. My wife had cooked spaghetti bolognese in honor of his Italian ancestry. And we realized that by the time all our plates were empty, he still had a fork with his first mouthful on there, and he'd never stopped talking. Not only is interesting that he never stopped talking, we never stopped listening. It was absolutely astounding to hear the stories and the passion. I mean, and that was the first part. Then he got up on stage and we didn't know what was coming and just blew everyone away because his focus was on Jesus and Jesus' call to the poor and the needy and the marginalized, and taking words of Jesus seriously. That was the small pebble he dropped into the church in the UK that created immense ripples for generations afterwards. I mean, we invited him back and invited him back and invited him back and invited him back.
You see, I would have thought you would have said he was, in his first visit, controversial. What do you think?
No, he wasn't controversial. I think there's a marked difference between what happened with Tony in the UK and what happened in America. Mm. When American evangelicals, which are much more right-wing and conservative than they are here, heard him, that they immediately accused him of being a communist, leftist, you know, and he's quoted the words of Jesus, you're a socialist, you know, yes, was here. There was a history. It's slightly complicated. The Lausanne Congress of World Evangelism had taken place in 1974 and created a Lausanne statement, which focused on the gospel being both in word and deed, crafted by John Stott mainly. So that really informed a bunch of people, including the story of the Congress is interesting in that when it was set up as a world Congress, the evangelical leaders in the UK boycotted it because they said, we're not having all this money spent on this, which meant that the C-list, people like me, Clive Calver, Youth for Christ, Doug Byer, a whole bunch of people who would never, ever have been invited, found ourselves at this place and absolutely gobsmacked by seeing the gospel in fresh, powerful ways. So we came back with that burning in our thinking. At that point, you've also got Tear Fund just launched, mm-hmm. which is beginning to talk to what's going on. And then very soon, you know, about that time, Clive Calver had become general director of the Evangelical Alliance and was particularly talking about recovering the mission of Shaftesbury and others. You know, they shaped society with concern about the slave trade and others. There was the seedbed here. There was the early flames. What Campolo did was pour petrol on them.
Sounds as if we need another Tony Campolo nowadays, especially after how you painted the picture in the 70s. The church seems to be losing its way now. If Tony had his life back again, what do you think he would do about it?
I think he'd do more of the same. We tend only to see in the UK, Tony on the surface, the tip of the iceberg, which is his public preaching and performances and so on. And we do hear of his stories of his mission stuff. But the one of the biggest things was he set up his Campolo Center for Ministry out of Eastern College in America and created bursaries for all sorts of people to go there to study how they could be effective for God in this world. And he also took them off to see poor initiatives so they can actually see it for themselves. I think our understanding in this country among the church is pretty good. I remember, it was probably 15, maybe 20, even 20 years ago now, I stood on a Spring Harvest platform and said, how many of you, I took a risk, I said, how many of you are in churches which 10 years ago had no program of social action for your community? And, you know, so I said, how many of you did have? And a fraction of hands went up, you know, smattering. Then I said, how many of you are in churches for which that's true now? And there was this great forest of hands. So there's been a transformation. And things like food banks and so on, I mean, the church is up for that. I think we're pretty good. Could be better. I'm not saying we couldn't be better, but I think Campolo would, you know, if he could smile down from heaven, and he's much too busy doing other things, I think he'd be doing well done. Look at the number of children who've been sponsored, you know, the amount of support that goes to agencies like Tear Fund, the initiatives in localities. So I think there is a mindset in the UK church now that's moved us beyond individual piety. Your righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees, to understand that the word righteousness is best translated justice. And we are called to work for a just and fair world.
Two final questions, if that's right. First one, when was the first time he came over to Spring Harvest, either Pontins or Butlins? What year are we talking about?
My mind doesn't allow me to do dates. I could do the research. My innate dyslexia keeps me from keeping a track of dates like that.
Gosh, you.
If I want to know when I was married, I look in my wedding ring, you know.
That's very good.
Late 70s, early 80s.
And secondly, if I had to ask you and put you on the spot, which I am going to do now, and say, which abiding story of all the stories you must have heard, which abiding story comes to mind, good sir?
Well, the one that comes to mind is him, you know, throwing a party for prostitutes in Honolulu to 2:30 in the morning. And I've recently rewatched it. It's a performance. It's brilliant. I think it's not only the power of the story, but the power of the way it's told. He tells it quite diffidently, you know, almost with his head down. He doesn't engage greatly with the audience at the beginning as he tells the story of going out early in the morning because of jet lag, buying some greasy food in a greasy cafe, of the prostitutes coming home from their night's business and hearing one of them say that she's her birthday's the following day, and then being inspired to, when they've gone, to hold a birthday party for her. And he tells that quite differently. And he comes to the point where the bartender says, you said you were, Campolo, you said you were a sociologist, he said, but you're clearly a preacher. He prayed for these women, which he said, it was a strange thing to do at the time, he said, but it seemed to be the right thing. He said, you're a preacher, he said. What kind of church do you preach in? This Tony's got his head down and he's quite still. And Tony said, I suddenly realized I had the right words. He said, I preach in churches that throw birthday parties for prostitutes at 2:30 in the morning.
Wow.
The bartender said, no, you don't, because I'd go to a church like that. And it's that point that Campolo comes alive, looks you in the eyes. He said, and wouldn't we all go to a church like that? Isn't what our church should be like? And suddenly he moves from this low key. And it's not just the power of the story. It's the way it comes from him. And you go, yes, we would, wouldn't we? Yes, we would. We're happier to live dirtier, messier lives and embrace people. No, we're more busy trying to keep people in, get people in, than keep people out. That's what rivets me. My other story was never told. He and his wife Peggy stayed with us, and we took him to Hampton Court, which was nearby, the King's House, as he called it. And my seven-year-old was there and decided he needed the toilet. So we sent him behind a tree. And Campolo suddenly came alive. He said, that kid, he said, he can. He's peeing in the King's back garden, he said. He braced life at every point.
My abiding memory, I've never heard him talk about it. I've read it in one of his books, how he goes to the funeral and walks in. And as soon as he sits down, he realises he might be in the wrong funeral in the church, because there's only about six or seven people there. He realised there and then he was in the wrong one, but he decided to stay. And afterwards, the wife got up and walked out. It was only Tony Campolo left, and he took her by the hand and said, my condolences, and ended up getting in the car with her and driving back, looking after her in the car, even though he'd gone to the wrong funeral.
Well, he tells the story of being late for a church where he's preaching, and he suddenly rushes in, and he's there, and he suddenly realizes it's the wrong church, and it's a totally black church, and he doesn't know what to do, and it's a lesson I've learned from him. He just says, isn't heaven going to be wonderful? And they all cheer. And he says, I'm on track here. I'm on track. But he was always in trouble. He blended sociology, understanding how the world worked, with sound theology and great practice. So he didn't just believe the right stuff. He did the right stuff. That was the blend that brought Campolo to us. And then, of course, a remarkable communicator.
Peter, thank you. Steve, 1982 means one thing to me. And that is going over to Spain to watch the World Cup, following England all around there, and also watching Northern Ireland. Little did I realise that a few years later I'd be moving to Northern Ireland. What does 1982 mean to you, he says knowingly?
Well, the visit of Tony Campolo for the first time as a speaker to Britain. I dosed myself up on all his tapes, as I say, for about a year and a half. I knew everything about him. And it's almost like you don't almost want to meet this mentor, do you? Almost the fear of meeting a hero is that you're going to find he's got feet of clay. There was an element of kind of fear that he would not be what I had turned him into.
Yes.
But he was exactly what I expected in terms of he was just him. I met him for the first time. He was speaking in one of the rooms at Prestatyn at Spring Harvest. And nobody knew who he was. He was completely unknown. 35 people turned up. I remember counting them.
Wow.
And he was talking on mid-marriage. And it was a really fascinating talk. And he was already entertaining people all over the place. And afterwards, I met him and I said, let's go and have a chat in our chalet. And we talked for over an hour. And it was at that point he said, I'm speaking tonight in the Big Top. And I need your help on this. And that was the point when he said to me, a few weeks ago, I was over in the States. I said to this congregation, according to UN statistics, 12,000 people will die tonight of starvation. And you don't give a What's worse is you're more bothered about the fact that I said the word that the 12,000 people will die tonight. And he said, do you think I should say this tonight in the Big Top? And it was like, oh, goodness me. I mean, he had 35 people in that first talk, but there were 3,000 people in the Big Top that night, all the great and the good.
Wow.
And he was leaving it to me as to whether he should say this.
So what did you say?
I said, you have to say it. Do it. Do it because it makes a point. And, you know, sometimes you just got to almost exaggerate to actually communicate. And I said at the back, well out of, I wasn't going to be on the platform party. I was going to be well out of the way of this one. I'm a coward. And I sat at the back waiting and waiting and waiting. And I thought, I will observe what happens when he says it. And I will remember what happens. And so it got to that point. According to UN statistics, 12,000. And he delivered the line. And it was fascinating because half the people clapped with approval and half were just sitting there astonished and sort of almost frightened. Who is this person? It wasn't like he had 10 years worth of being sensible, safe and pleasant. And he just made this one point. They didn't know who he was. He didn't know who they were. And he took the risk. And that's what I loved about him all the time. There was always a massive risk taking thing in him that he had to do that. What was interesting was that I wanted to keep the tape afterwards,
yeah,
so that I could sort of prove that it actually happened. I've got the tape later on, maybe a week or two later after a Spring Harvest. The funny thing was that section had been snipped out of the tape.
Ah.
And I always wondered who made that decision.
Yeah.
I can understand it to a degree. It could be misinterpreted and misunderstood by people who weren't in the Big Top at the time. But it never appeared on the tape. And yet, let me tell you, wherever I go, there are people who remember that incident or know about it but weren't there.
Or, in my case, I've been brought up on that story since, the mid-1990s, I would say. But it was the F word that he said, and it was at Greenbelt. Now, I mean, I don't know whether he did it again at Greenbelt or whatever, but, wow. Editing, hey? Just to look after people who might be offended. And that was a point he was trying to prove.
Exactly. And of course, then the issue of personal piety, he was very big on this issue. You know, a member of the same address, he said, how many people here tonight became a Christian because you found out your friend didn't smoke or didn't drink or didn't go to the cinema? And then nobody put their hands up. And he said, how many people became a Christian because somebody loved them and cared for them and saw them into the kingdom with love? And virtually everybody put their hands up in the Big Top. And it was so interesting that he then talked, and this is like the other big issue that always I think was important, was the difference between power and authority. This was the other great theme of Campolo. And I don't know whether you want to develop that now, but to me, that was the central message that he had.
Let's talk about that in a minute, if that's all right. In light of that little story you told, in one of his books I read, because like you, I was voracious. I needed, once I found this chap, I needed to know more. And he put a different twist on it in his book, whereby he was in what I call, one of his enormo domes. You know, we got 10,000 people there. And he said, okay, I can't do an impersonation like you can, so just bear with me on this one. But he's always loud, isn't he? He's very brash in the way he speaks, very deliberate. And he said, how many of you tonight, all of you raise your hands and start bringing your hands down. How many of you tonight became a Christian because you were so desperate in life that you walked out thinking, I'm going to die, I'm going to commit suicide, but I'll try a church, and you walk into a church. You know, maybe like one or two people just put their hands down, the rest get them up. He says, how many of you then were driving along thinking, I want to end my life or I'm really fed up, and you switch on the radio station? Of course, by this time I was working in Christian radio, so this appealed to me. But in America, you've got like 1,600 radio stations, so it's not difficult. He said, now how many of you went on, tuned in, found a Christian radio station, heard the love of Christ, and therefore became a Christian? You know, maybe another one or two people put their hands down. And the rest were, how many of you became a Christian because of the way that a neighbour came in when you were lonely, when you were desperate, when you were fed up with life, came in and just showed you Christ's love in action, made you a cup of tea or whatever, and virtually everybody's hand came down. The point I take that is that, yeah, all the other things can be good, but we're missing the most important thing. And I think that's where you want to come in a minute later on, if that's right, with personal piety. But before we do, Let's bring in another guest, if that's all right. And this is Dr. Ash Barker, who I interviewed a few weeks ago. In fact, it was Ash Barker who actually broke the news to me. This is what Ash had to say.
Oh, Tony had such a big influence on my life. I stood up as an 18-year-old, willing to go anywhere for the cause of Christ. I was in my youth group, and I grew up in a pretty conservative kind of background, and it was the first time I really heard, I think, the radical call to follow Jesus and to surrender all. And I stood up, thought I was going to go to China for some reason. I'm not sure why. I met Ange 6 months later. She thought she was going to Haiti. And we fell madly in love, got married as 20-year-olds. And yeah, for the last 35 years, we're on three continents, we've been trying to live out that call. His writings were really important to me. You know, one of the books that people don't know a lot about is We Have an Enemy and They're Partly Right. And it was all about Marx and Nietzsche and all these kind of philosophers basically saying they've got something, we've got a critique of Christianity we've got to take seriously. I loved that book. He really turned my mind on. As I say, I went to a failing kind of government school. The thought that someone like me could get a PhD at a divinity school from Australia is due to Tony awakening that I had a brain, that I could love God with my heart and my soul and my mind and my strength. But the mind bit, you know, it was all Tony. In 2003, we'd been in Bangkok a few years. We were really worried. A lot of those kind of radical calls for discipleship, people like John Smith and Tim Costello, people may be aware of over here, Dave Andrews, those voices were really being marginalized. And it was those big kind of mega churches that were kind of dominating. Everyone wanted to be a mega church. And so we really felt like we were losing our base in Australia, and that the next generation could disappear, you know, because they're not going to be hanging around mega churches very long. And so Tony was willing to come and be our first speaker at Surrender. We had no money at all, but we were able, on the back of Tony, we're able to let him speak at their church on Sunday, the big city centre church, if we had their auditorium and building for the Friday and the Saturday. And we got other speakers, of course, because Tony was there, he wanted to be there. We made sure Indigenous voices were a part of it. And a lot of people love Tony. That's why they came, but they heard Indigenous Christian voices for the first time. And so the Surrender Conference continues to this day, and a whole generation of people in Australia, like myself, have been influenced by Tony. When I came to the UK, nothing kind of worked as it planned. And, you know, Tony sent me a book called Intimacy in Action, and his signature and a little message, and I keep the faith. And so if there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And called me, and we had a long chat. And basically, you know, he came over. He helped to start Change Makers in London and Luton and Birmingham here. And then we started Red Letter Christians, which is about strengthening this call to radical discipleship and making sure activists don't feel alone. He invested his own money, to gave us $50,000 to help make it work. And I'll never forget him and Shane coming out. We did like a 10-city tour, and I was in the back of, but, and I love Tony speaking, but I probably could have done some of the talks by the end, I think, myself. But my highlight would always be sitting in the back of the minivan with Tony, hearing his stories, how he met Castro and how he met Einstein and how he supported the Clintons through the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And I mean, he was just amazing to listen to. I was worried. We got up to Manchester, and it's quite a journey, in a 2-hour or so journey from Birmingham. And it was like the fourth or fifth day of the tour, and we couldn't stop him. And we're at Nazarene Theological College for the day teaching. And by the evening, we had a really big majority Black Pentecostal church that was speaking. And Shane was there. I said to Tony, you know, maybe you're exhausted. You're looking really tired. And he was kind of shrinking. I was really worried. My obituary would be Ash Barker, the guy who killed Tony Campolo. I was really worried. And so maybe leave this one to Shane. You know, you can pick up, there's more coming tomorrow, but maybe you get an early night. He just wouldn't have it. Shane kind of was fantastic. And then Tony got up. And as I say, he was kind of bent over. He was in his 80s, early 80s at this point. And he got up, and I thought, oh no, I'm going to embarrass Tony. We've worked him too hard. But it was like Popeye eating spinach. But suddenly he just kind of grew and grew and grew animated. And his passion and his humor and the stories and his call to discipleship. You know, hundreds of people came forward that night to surrender their lives to Jesus. And so I think I'll always remember Tony for his stories, but also, yeah, his willingness to do some of those hidden things. A lot of people see Tony as this kind of great speaker and communicator, and he is that, but he's also this mystic. He goes into these very quiet places, ask God to fill him fresh with the Holy Spirit, and comes out animated is the only way I can describe it. And it has been a lesson to me. I went over to Philadelphia a few times and Eastern College. You see Tony on his own home ground is amazing. He goes into the local diner and they all kind of know Joe's Diner, you know, he took me for breakfast, and on the walls all these photographs, and so, oh, I wonder who's, and Tony's in most of them, and it's Bill Clinton and it's, you know, Bono, and you know, he was just so amazingly connected. But then he would spend time with people like me. I was never going to be the speaker or the writer that Tony is, but yet he would always use his authority and his kind of gate opening kind of skills for people like me. And I know he did that for thousands of people. And so I'm going to miss Tony. There are not many who have his intelligence and passion and wit and wisdom. And I think we've lost a one of a kind. But I do feel like his work is not done yet. And it is up to people like us to carry on. Red Letter Christians is an amazing network here in the UK. It continues on. We have these morning pauses at 8 o'clock on Facebook Live, and the books, Jesus and Justice books, have come out trying to amplify the voices of people who are taking Jesus and Justice seriously. And so in lots of ways, Red Letter Christians with Shane and others, yeah, are continuing on his legacy.
And Shane being?
Shane Claiborne is kind of a prodigy of Tony in Philadelphia. He's based in a city, Philadelphia. His book, The Irresistible Revolution, is a brilliant book. And yeah, Shane stayed quite a few times. I've been texting backwards and forwards the last few days. But he, in lots of ways, is the heir apparent of what Tony could do. He's both of them got arrested a lot of times. But I think Shane's even outstripping Tony for the number of civil disobedience arrests that they've had.
Very quickly, you do want to hear my story.
Yes.
And then you can maybe on the back end tell us about Castro as well. I was invited up 1997. I just got married to Alison. And this phone call came through from a chap in Newcastle upon Tyne saying, you need to come up and meet this chap. I can get you an interview. And I said, well, hey, who are you? And he said, well, we're running this thing. We've got a thing at Newcastle City Hall. Now, that sold it to me. Because in my rock history days, Newcastle City Hall, Emerson, Lake and Palmer recorded Pictures of Exhibition there. But I'd never really heard of this Tony Campolo bloke, especially it was going to be like a 500-mile round trip. But he talked me into going. I'm so glad he did, because we got up there. We had half an hour interview with him booked in his hotel room. Now, my wife, Alison, was really bad with ME by this time. He said at the bottom of the lift, well, we can go up the stairs. And I said, well, my wife's not at all well. No, how he speaks, you know, we'll go in the lift. So we go up, and he had a very unassuming suite. We walk in, he said, Alison, you can lie on my bed. So we've made a joke about that. Obviously, you can work out your own punchline on that one. The interview started, and I had the microphone in my hand. Off it went, and I said, well, Tony, I understand that, you know, you have dealings with the President of the United States, and you go in there once a month or whatever to talk to President Clinton. What did you discuss? 5 seconds later, my hand was shaking. This is not going to go well with the hierarchy, because he said, well, he said, some people don't like what his stances are. And I said, well, what's the stance then? And he said, well, homosexuality in the Army and the Navy. So all I said was, what's that then? And he shared it. Phenomenal. And I'm thinking, this is not going to be able to go out live, is it? And then at the very end, I thought, right, okay, we'll see if we can get away with this. But this is what I was thinking. And I said, well, Tony, thank you very much indeed for that. I'd like you to discuss now who your Christian hero is. Someone, you know, who inspires you that is dead, so that we can't obviously get rebuked from it afterwards when it goes out. So, Tony Campolo, who is your Christian hero? And he said, well, there's just one Christian hero for me. He said, and that's Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And I went, oh, no, this isn't going to go out either. Because if you knew the politics at the time at a certain radio station, most people who were funding it were coming from the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Oh.
So I went back and I saw my boss, who I'm still in touch with today. And I said, have a listen to this. And he said, you know, that's probably the greatest interview you've ever done. And unfortunately, no one will ever hear it.
Wow. I would love to have heard it. I can imagine.
He explained about the stance of homosexuality and the fact that his wife was in full favour of it.
Yeah.
And he explained why it was going to be a cause of problem within the Christian church and everything else like that. So that's what he shared. And everything else on top of that, well, it was out the window.
How did that nearly kill your wife?
How did Tony Campone nearly kill my wife? Well, he came over about 10 years ago to do a tour so he could promote, I can't remember what the sponsorship for a child organisation was called, but he was heavily involved in that.
Compassion.
And he was at St. Patrick's Church here in Coleraine. And I'd had this phenomenal session with him. So I emailed him beforehand. Said, if you're ever coming over, we'd love to have 5 minutes with you, if that's all right. And he very kindly emailed back. Said, yes, we'll meet at half time in the church. So I go over, and to my dying shame, he was sitting next to his wife. I introduced myself and introduced me to his wife. And I should have spent more time with his wife, and I didn't. And I'm really annoyed about that, because it's like, yes, you might be his wife, but this is Tony, you know? And it's like, I feel really bad about that. But he said, right, we need to go and find somewhere to talk. And we knew the building, but for some reason, I was, I suppose, in awe of Tony. And he said, well, where can we go? Can we go? And he saw that 10 yards away was the organ pit, and the organ was sunk into the ground by about 6 foot. And the way down to it were these narrow little wooden steps.
Yes.
So here's my wife, who by this time is completely registered blind. And like, we're trying to circumnavigate around all the chairs, and people saw, well, where are those three going? He said, well, get hold of my hand, dear. He's trying to pull my wife down the steps. She was like falling all over the place. How we got her in and how we got her out of that pit, I'll never know. But yeah, he could have killed my wife. That's the story behind it. And then what he shared as well to us as well was phenomenal. So I can hold on to that.
Oh, I must admit, the first time Tony spoke for us at Surrender, there was some kind of mixing conversation. He was kind of saying, yeah, what is it you need in Bangkok? You know, and I said, oh, look, this is young adults. I don't have any money. This is about doing for them what you did for me. You know, said, oh, no, you've got to tell us, you know, what's the biggest need you're facing in Bangkok? I said, well, we've got a community center in school and we need it at $1,500 or $15,000 or it's going to close down. But look, please, you know, don't bring that up. People will be, you know, they want to hear you speak. They don't want to hear your front. I need to know these things. So anyway, he got on, like his whole big call that first time was to give money to our community centre in Klong Toi. They raised the $1,500. The schools survived. I'll never forget him saying, I'm not saying you'll go to hell if you don't support these slum kids, but why take a chance? He was a phenomenal fundraiser for
stunning,
all kinds of things in education and health and child sponsorship.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, he was a dynamo, and so many people are alive today because of Tony.
I know the story about Einstein, so I can share it later on. Knew nothing about his story with Mr. Fidel Castro. So what do you know?
Yeah, so there were secret kind of discussions going on. American businesses do trade in Cuba. And so Tony and a number of American businessmen were kind of smuggled in to Cuba to have these kind of secret discussions with the American government. They were Christian businessmen by and large, and they got to meet Castro. And Castro apparently does these talks that go for hours, you know, and he was telling how their health and their education and everything's so amazing, you know, so much better than America. And eventually one of the businessmen pluck up the courage to say, well, we're Christians, you know, we hear that Christians are persecuted here. What is it you're afraid about Christianity that you need to persecute us? He says, no, we don't persecute Christians here. In fact, my minister for, I think it was education or labor, is a Baptist Christian. When we took over the revolution, we decided that I was going to be the wolf. You're the wolf. Yeah, I'm the wolf. Okay, well, what do you mean? Well, we knew a lot of the Catholic priests have been involved with trying to stop the Bay of Pigs or try and support that outside people. So we rounded them up and we sent them back to Spain. We knew the Protestants hadn't been, but we wanted to see what was going on. So we rounded them up, all the ministers as well, and we said to them, we know you weren't involved with this conspiracy, but you can stay under one condition. You can preach on the weekends, but you've got to work in the fields during the week, like other people are, and be part of the revolution. And then he said, I'm the wolf. And they go, what do you mean I'm the wolf? Well, your Jesus says that the wolf comes and the bad shepherds, you know, the hired hands, they leave, but the good shepherds stay. Well, the hired hands left and they went to America and other places, but the good shepherds stayed and they have become a remarkable part of our society here. And we welcome Christians here because they're the good shepherds. They worked in the fields on the weekends and then they served in the churches on the weekends. And we have the most respect for them. I was the wolf for you. You can thank me.
Wow. What did Tony say privately afterwards or something like that to him?
Tony just kind of tells the story, really. So, but he was there when all that happened.
Wow.
But yeah, that's his Castro story. Apparently there's a documentary going to be made about that whole event, but I've never seen it. Yeah.
So there you go, Steve. That's Dr. Ash Barker. Ash telling the story, obviously, about Fidel Castro. Yes, I'm sure there are other stories as well. Maybe we can talk about Einstein later on, that one, because that's just amazing. But you alluded beforehand about personal piety, but you think there's actually a bigger subject to discuss regarding Tony's mission. What do you think it was?
Yeah, I think it's, and again, it's the thing that hit me most of all about what he was saying, was he made sense of the gospel in a new kind of way from a sociological perspective. For that, he looked to one of the key sociologists of the last century, Max Weber, who defined power as the prerogative to determine what happens and the coercive force to make others yield to your wishes, even against their own will. And this last phrase actually is crucial because for the coercive nature of power gives expression to its potential for evil. So coercion is the crux of why power is irreconcilable with Christianity. This was one of Campolo's really big points. So when a leader is able to persuade others to do his will without coercion, he presents himself in a way that people want to obey him. When they recognize him as a legitimate leader with the right to expect compliance with his wishes. Now that is authority, not power. And he constantly made this point of the difference between power and authority. And his point was this, that as Christians, we have to be about the transformation of minds and wills through the use of the authority that we've earned. Not that it's just given to us. We have to earn an authority. And how do we earn that authority? It is actually through other-centered love that flows from God to others. And that's the great challenge. Because when we look at, let's put it into an American context, when we look at the kind of the right-wing element of evangelicalism in the US, and you can see Campolo reacting against this all the time, that it's all about power. It's all about getting into power and then asserting and making the gospel happen within that context. And his view was that we have to earn the right to bring the gospel to people who will respond to us if we have an authority. If we only using power, you know, you can't make somebody love you. It's the same issue here. And so this was an incredible theme of Campolo's ministry. He would put it into a biblical context. Pharaoh had the power. Moses had the authority. Nebuchadnezzar had the power. Daniel had the authority. Herod had the power. Jesus had the authority. And this was a constant theme throughout his talks. And that was enormously influential to me.
How many times do you think you heard him talk?
Oh, 150 times.
I know he went on tour, for want of a better word, to various churches up and down the length and breadth of Great Britain. But how many times did he change a story every night and think, oh, he answered that before?
Obviously, there are a lot of repeats, but there are also lots of new stories all the time. But the thing was, he spoke without notes most of the time.
Really?
I mean, it was just incredible to actually watch him stick to a theme without having any notes, and to not just to talk. He'd been given a subject and he stuck to the subject. It wasn't just like, oh, he's my pet, one of my pet five sermons. He'd be given some subject and he would somehow bend it all into what his philosophy was. Yeah. But he would never entirely go away from what he'd been given to talk about. And I found that really interesting. And I also think, look at him as an artist. he had this ability to entertain, to be a virtuous stand-up comedian at one point, but also to kind of pull you back into being a dynamic evangelist and calling people to repentance and faith, you know. So the artist in him was very impactful and impressive.
Yeah, exactly. What was your job role then in all those years working alongside Tony?
Well, it was always informal. It was pro bono. There was no money involved. And I had a PR consultancy which earned me my living. And I said to Tony, look, I'm quite happy to work for you on the side. So it's sort of like, if you want me to put out something, then I will do it and I'll put it out to the media. And of course, when Bill Clinton made Tony his spiritual advisor after the Lewinsky scandal,
yeah,
then he was suddenly a very, very significant person in this country and in obviously in the US, because Bill Clinton mentioned him in the State of Union address out of the blue. Campola was watching the State of Union address, and Bill Clinton said, if only we had work going on like my friend Tony Campolo is doing in such and such, then our whole world would change. And Campolo said, I was sitting there in my chair thinking, he's just mentioned me.
Yeah.
And then he's saying, the phone never stopped buzzing. Who are you? Why has he mentioned you? What are you doing? And so from then on, the PR side was important, because he had to make sure he was responding correctly and taking up the right sort of opportunities. So I only did it as a friend, obviously specifically in the UK, for 2 or 3 years. And he was so grateful that he said to me one day, he was a big fan of Ship of Fools, the website which I run with Simon Jenkins, or did at that point. And he said, look, you've helped me and nothing for it. I'll give you a day in London. If you want me to speak at anything you're doing, I will come and speak for you. And so we got together with Premier Radio, and we put on an event in Westminster Central Hall, which was packed out with 3 weeks' notice.
Wow.
They came from all over for that. And Simon Jenkins and I sort of presented Ship of Fools, but only for 5-10 minutes. And then Campolo just took over and just did his thing. And he did it for us as a favour. It was a lovely way of him saying thank you for the PR.
I'm not deliberately trying to portray the other side, but he can be known as being Mr. Controversial. What do you think about him being controversial?
Yeah, I think that was part of his character. I think he always pushed people to the edge. He always sort of said, well, okay, you're thinking that, but what about this on the other side? In that sense, he was a good academic.
Yeah.
You know, he would make you rethink your basis for anything. He'd say, okay, you're thinking that, well, what about the other side? What about the other way of looking at this issue? And I think that that was part of his character, and that was part of his intellect, really. And it was great, because it pushed me at times. I didn't even agree with him on some things, but at least he made me figure out why I didn't agree with him and why I didn't think that issue through. I realized I hadn't thought the issue through clearly enough or deeply enough. So, yeah, it was great. Always stimulating.
If you could just tell me your favourite Tony Campolo story, either a personal incident or something you would share on the stage, what would it be?
With my Ship of Fools hat on, Simon Jenkins and I created a thing called the Mystery Worshipper.
Yes.
Where we send mystery worshippers out to critique church services.
Yes.
Thousands now of critiques have been done on Ship of Fools. They're posted up. They've been going up there since the late 90s. And worshippers or anybody can go to a church they've never been to before, preferably one not of their tradition.
Yes.
And critique the length of the sermon, the hardness of the pews, the after church coffee, anything. There's a kind of, on a scale of 1 to 10, would you invite anybody to this church? And it sort of has become part and parcel of the Ship of Fools persona, really.
Yeah.
One time, Campolo was at the Christian Resource Exhibition in 2005. We had done Mystery Worshipper Sunday, where we'd sent 70 mystery worshippers out on one Sunday to critique all the churches around Greater London, or 70 of them, and to report back. We announced the fact that this was going to happen. The media got hold of it, made a big deal of it. This Sunday, in a church near you, you may get a visit of a mystery worshipper. So I was telling Campolo about this, that had gained all this publicity, and that we had, as a result of this, the Macmillan English Dictionary had put mystery worshipper into their dictionary as a new phrase. And I was boasting about this to Campolo, kind of, how about that? And he said, yeah, I can just see you standing in front of the pearly gates. St. Peter says to you, did you feed the poor? Did you care for the sick? And what can you say, Goddard? You can say, no, but I got mystery worshipper into the dictionary. I mean, that was how he could deflate, he could burst your bubble. And I don't know why I thought of that one, but maybe that's because of his sense of humour and that irony again. I just loved it for it.
It's something that he would do as well. Yeah. He would never build himself up.
No.
You know, you should always make yourself look small.
Exactly.
That story does that exactly.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well done, you. And if anyone wants to say, but who is this? He can't say Steve Goddard. Did he say Goddard? How did he say your name?
Hey, Goddard. Hey, Goddard. In America, if you're over there, it's always Goddard. But then you've got your own story. I mean, your memory of him talking about Einstein, which is a story I've forgotten.
Just before I do, though, for those who want to know more about Steve Goddard, please listen to episode 72, where he explains more about Shipper Falls, what it is, and who Steve Goddard really is. Yes, I had the privilege, and one of the stories he told me was about growing up as an Italian descendant in New York. And he apparently was really, really clever growing up in school. And then he was singled out because he had brains on him and he seemed to be really good at physics. And out of all the people in his year and all the people around him and everything else like that, he had the pleasure of meeting Einstein and coming under his tutorage. And he said that Albert Einstein told him a story once whereby he was sitting on a park bench. This was Albert Einstein. Wherever the park was, I can't remember. But he was minding his own business. Here is the famed Albert Einstein. What he doesn't know about E equals MC squared isn't worth knowing about. He's sitting there and all of a sudden this like 7 or 8 year old kid comes along crying and sits next to him on a park bench. And he's crying his eyes out. Albert Einstein says, are you okay? I can't do the impersonation of, you know, how Albert Einstein would speak. The kid says, oh, I can't do my homework. I can't do it. He said, what's the matter? What homework is it? He said, I'm doing my maths. I don't understand it. And he said, would you like me to help you? And the boy said, well, do you know anything about maths? And he went, well, yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So anyway, the kid gets out his maths book. Notice the word maths, please, not math. Gets out his maths book. And Albert goes through it and explains it to him. And the kid obviously is dead chuffed. No idea who this white-haired bloke was. Helps him with his homework. Goes off, obviously skipping and jumping. Goes back to his mum and dad, gets in. Mummy, daddy, look, what's happened? And so he regales the story. Of course, the parents, even in those days, were aghast that there was this old man talking to his boy, really, really worried that he was helping out little children. And so they call the police. The police take a description of who he is, go along and arrest him. He's taken back to the police headquarters or wherever it was. And they started to interrogate him. What were you up to? Blah, 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 blah. And of course, he says, well, look, my name is Albert Einstein. And did they believe him at first? No, they didn't. That was the whole thing. So Albert Einstein was arrested because he was looking after this little kid. Now, I don't think the little kid was Tony Campolo, but that would have made it even a better story if it had been. But yes, so he came under the tutorage of Albert Einstein.
I didn't know that story.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I don't remember that one at all. It may have escaped my memory, but all I remember is him talking about, obviously, Einstein. And looking at physics and looking at the, you know, the whole relativity issue and how Christians have to deal with this. And every age, there's a change of understanding our science and that Christianity has to adapt to that. We have no option, but we have to do that. And so that I remember, but I didn't remember that little story. That anecdote is brilliant.
Here's another gentleman who wishes to share what he thought of Tony Campolo. From episode 54 is Michael Harvey, author and chief executive of Unlocking the Growth Trust. What does Tony Campolo mean to you?
Tony Campolo was so instrumental in my early Christian journey as a teenager, some 4 decades ago now. I remember in Sunday school, we used to have Tony Campolo being played to us as a Sunday school class.
Wow.
And what I remember kind of most of all from Tony Campolo was his famous sermon, "It's Friday, but Sunday's coming." And it was such an exciting sermon because it builds to a crescendo and he's almost shouting, "It's Friday, but Sunday's coming." And he's riffing, if I remember rightly, of somebody that he's heard actually kind of do a sermon like this. It was Campolo's style, his way of really bringing to life the idea that, you know, at times it really feels like Friday in our lives, you know, where everything's dead, everything's barren, nothing's working whatsoever. But hang on, you know, kind of Sunday's coming. And this, for me, is symptomatic of the Christian life. The Christian life is almost like reliving, retelling, re-experiencing the life, yes, but the death and the resurrection of Jesus as we grow in our Christian lives. And so Campolo kind of really hit it right for me. And I've come back to that sermon, which you can find on YouTube, over and over and over again, because there's plenty of Fridays, plenty of times where you think, oh my goodness, you know, kind of life is rubbish, absolutely rubbish at the moment. I have no idea where God might be. But the good thing is that Sunday is coming. And my goodness, Tony Campolo, now that he's sadly died, he's passed on, just as he also had the message passed on to him. He's passed that message on. And it's our job, our duty in our generation to remind those who are going through really, really tough times that it is Friday, but Sunday's coming. And Tony Campolo, well done, good and faithful servant. You have done an amazing kind of job in the life that you've lived. And so it's for our generation to pass this message on.
As far as the sermon is concerned, that's one thing. So obviously people can listen to it on YouTube. But what else did you get from that? And what have you applied from that sermon to your career working for Jesus?
I think for me, there is some phraseology in that sermon, if I remember it rightly, that it's Friday, Mary's crying her eyes out because her Jesus is dead. But it's only Friday. It's only Friday. And for me, the idea that there are times where tears flow, there are times when there's sadness, there's times when, you know, ministry really, really does look as if it's dead, it's come to an end. But hold on. And that's what the message has done, is it's a reminder. It was a message of reality, you know, of real reality, that kind of God is often in places that you know, you don't think God is. He's in the margins of society. He's in the places where the world says he isn't. And so that's why it's so helpful to ministry, because it's just a reminder that the gospel comes out of bad news. So I want to kind of go against this idea. It's always when you get the last parking place at the supermarket. The gospel is about life coming from death, Martin.
Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I cannot ever remember ever seeing him live. But in the back of my mind, I am sure when I was kind of doing something in Manchester with the Evangelical Alliance, that he was definitely at an event, but I can't remember meeting him personally.
Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I think it's only fair as we wrap up this special podcast regarding the life and times of Tony Campolo, Steve, if we make proper mention of his wife of all those years and how she put up with him. As I mentioned earlier on, I never really spent any more than like 5 seconds, so pleased to meet you, Peggy. He introduced me to her and I just wanted to talk to Tony. That was so rude of me, and hopefully I'll never ever do that kind of thing again. As far as you're concerned then, Peggy, his wife all those years, what do you remember of her?
A very sweet lady, and very, very bright as well, and very determined. but always so much a family lady. Somebody who was warm to me and to Alison, my wife. We would have lunch together and talk family matters through, not just the big issues of life, but to talk family life through. I remember the particular story about her, because there was a lot of ego in that family. There was Campolo, there was his son Bart, there was their daughter Lisa. You kind of had this energy. She said, Peggy Howe, they were always talking, they're always almost scrapping intellectually, and she was just mum. And yet one day she graduated herself, and I don't know what degree it was, and she received the certificate or the acknowledgement that she passed. And she said she went upstairs, went to the toilet and said, look, wait till I come down and show you this, you lot. It was almost, the way she described it was so brilliant, but she was just the mum, you know what I mean? But actually, underneath it all, she could match any of them. So she had that kind of spirit to her as well. And she was always very, very determined on her views of things as well. But at the end of the day, they were just a lovely couple, and we regarded them as family, really.
How would you sum up his life, and also how he affected you?
One of the probably three or four key people in my life, really, in terms of impact, and I miss him enormously. But then on the other hand, I celebrate his life in a way that I hope that I would celebrate the way he would, and said that when he died, he wanted to be laid out in the coffin. He wanted a smile to be put kind of permanently on his face, and his hand outstretched like this in the coffin, so that when he entered heaven, he would be waving and smiling at people from the moment he entered glory. And I loved that as a picture. And as I put in my own obit to him, he was very, very busy on the 19th of November, waving at a lot of people as he came through the pearly gates. Just a lovely thing, because to him it was just he was passing on, he was passing over, and he wanted to be ready to celebrate.
Steve Goddard, or Steve Goddard as we say over here, thank you so much for spending all the time with us today.
Absolute pleasure.
And if anybody would like to know more about Steve Goddard, well, they can go and listen to episode 72. They want to know more about Tony Campolo, please go onto YouTube. There's plenty of clips on there. His books are amazing. Well worth reading. Loads of little stories in there, and the way he puts it across, absolutely phenomenal. If anyone wants to know more, please contact us. Thank you. Cheerio. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
When I was a kid, I'm talking in the mid-80s, I was not interested in what you would call CCM. Contemporary Christian music to me as a genre often felt like it was music made for Christians. It was not music made by Christians for the whole world. That was always what was exciting to me. Music that was marketed and manufactured and intended strictly for Christians always felt like a bit of a put-on. It tended to have to go through certain hoops and things that made it less interesting creatively, because the Christian market couldn't tolerate ambiguity, and it couldn't tolerate risk, and they couldn't cover certain topics and things that I thought were important to cover. So the art side of it suffered. But when Christians made art with their Christianity latent, as Tolkien and Lewis would have said, it made for some of the best art.
So please join me and returning guest, creative director at Capitol Records, and now university director of music industry studies, John J. Thompson. Until then, cheerio.